everyone. We're starting Sefer Bamidbar. We're getting out to crunch time. We have only Parashas Bamidbar and Parashas Nasa left before we will take our summer leave of each other until next year. No pun intended. Really. No hint intended. Just see you all next year. If not here, then at least you could be listening in via the internet, like Benny does. Hi, Benny. Don't hit the tree, Benny. Okay. This week's Parshas, Parshas Bamidbar, which at first glance is not entirely exciting to a lot of people. It's mostly a census. But nevertheless, individual psukim certainly have some excitement. But before we get into the actual Parsha, let's just discuss two midrashim that are seemingly contradictory to one another. In the parsha opens up by Daber Hashem al Moshe b'Midbar Sinai b'Ol Moed b'Echad L'Chomesh. God spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the desert, in the wilderness. And this, the Midrash says, that Torah is like a desert. Torah is compared to a desert. In what sense is Torah compared to a desert? A desert is filled with what?
Sand.
No, you're sand. Dirt. Right? So, what's the point of the Midrash? The Midrash says, just like dirt is everywhere and is easily accessible, right? That's why we call something, gold is expensive. Why is gold expensive? Because it's rare. But dirt, we call it dirt cheap. It's everywhere. It's, you can have easy access to it. That's what, anything that you can have easy access. Right? So Torah is easily accessible. Torah is easily accessible, says the magician. That's why the Torah was given in the Midbar. That is why Torah is often compared to a Midbar. Okay, a very nice magician, a nice idea. Everyone can get something in Torah. Everyone can be a part of Torah. And that's a great word unto itself. Here is a slightly complicated part. The next Midrash, right there, following point, says the Torah is compared to a Midbar. Why is the Torah is compared to a Midbar? I mentioned this once before in a different context. Why is the Torah compared to a Midbar? Says the Midrash, because just like the Midbar is empty, it has nothing in it, so too, if you really want to achieve anything in Torah, if you want Torah to be part of your life, you have to make yourself empty. You have to make yourself like a desert. I want right now an ice cream, but no, I'm going to give up my desire of ice cream because I don't have the time to walk to the store and back. Instead, I'm going to learn. I right now want a, what is it now, a 2 shekel pack of gum right outside of the base medrash. What?
Down the house.
For a pack of gum?
Yeah.
For a piece.
No,
for
a
piece.
Okay. I want a pack of gum. 2 shekel. I'm going to give it up. I'm not going to get up from my chair. Right? And those are the easy things. What about the harder things? I right now want to go and hang out with my friends. I right now want to see my 1,000 friends on Facebook. I right now want to go play all of those. I want to be on the basketball court. I want to be in front of a movie screen. I want to be 1,001 things that are all better and more enticing than Torah. The Torah, if you really want, you're going to have to give that up. Right? So this Midrash makes it seem like Torah is not accessible to everyone. This is very difficult, right? For me to give up my desires. I know that I myself want, but I have to give it up. That's very hard. So how can one reconcile these two Midrashim? So Rav Goldbeck Zatzal, the former Rosh Yeshiva of Keren B'Yavne, uncle to the one from YU, right? So he said the following in his sefer, Asufas Ma'arachos is the name of the sefer, and it's a sikha that he gave. The sefer is really just a printing of the sikha that he gave. He said the following. He said it's true. The first midrash is true, and the second midrash is true. The first midrash is true that, one, Torah is easily accessible to anyone who wants. And the second midrash is true that you have to invest, really, and give it your all, and give up your desires in order to have a part in Torah. How can they both be true? He said it's very simple. It depends on the level of affiliation that you would like to have with Torah. The example I like to give is the following. When I was a high school student, sometimes for fun we would go, well, I shouldn't say sometimes, once or twice, three times, 10 times max. We used to go to a store called FAO Schwartz. Why did we used to go to a store called FAO Schwartz? A, because it was close by to the Ramaz Upper School. And B, because the Chab of FAO Schwartz at the time, which no other toy store had, was that they let you play with every toy in the store. It was in Fifth Avenue in a very prominent place, and it was like, it's four levels or five levels of toys everywhere. Right? It was amazing. Anything. So we would go and we would play with the Barbies. That's a joke, everyone. Right? We'd play with whatever it was. They had like that famous piano that from the movie Big that you could step on and play. We would play with the G.I. Joes, with the cars, with the laser tag. Laser tag was a big one.
This is high school.
This is nice. Yeah.
Why do you have to hate so much?
Right? So, we would go. Now, it was a great time. Always a good time to be had at FAO Schwartz. But what would happen when we would leave? Would we take the laser tag with us? Would we take the Atari, or at the time when the Nintendo came out, would we take the Nintendo system? The answer is
no.
No, why not? Because you have to pay for it, right? Simple as that, right? Even your math students know you have to pay for it. Right. Definitely your math students. Very honest. So you have to pay for it. So what's the pshat over here? So you see that there is a level of accessibility that I have to the toys, even when I don't own them, when I just want to play with them. And it's, but if I really want to own the toy and play with it always and have it be mine, what do I have to do? I have to buy it. I have to pay cash. It's the same thing with Torah. I can have two levels of affiliation with Torah. I can have a flirtatious relationship with Torah. Like a midbar, it's accessible, yes. But will I really be owning it? Will it be ingrained in me, part and parcel of my life, if I'm not willing to invest? The answer is no. Yeah, I can peruse its pages, I can read through Chumash, and I can read through Tanakh, and Mishnah, and Gemara. I can go through Shas. But if I want Shas to go through me, as they say, then I have to be willing to invest a little bit more. And that's why the Midrashim are not contradicted. It's two different levels of affiliation. There's the flirtatious relationship with Torah, cheap as dirt. Anyone can do that. But if you really want it to be part of your life, if you want it to permeate every single thing that you do, in the workplace, in the school, on the playground, in all, in your family life, in everything that you do, it's going to require an investment. You're going to have to give up of yourself sometimes and subjugate yourself and submit yourself to the greater will of God and the Torah. Okay, that is idea number one. Okay, idea number two.
I don't know how to take notes.
What?
I don't know how to take notes. My hand fills my hand.
Alright, you don't have to take notes.
I want to, I just don't have to.
There are classes for people like you.
Really?
Note taking classes, sure.
I'd like to take one of those classes.
I don't know, you sign up.
Take notes in those classes. Okay.
That's a good question. I think they give you the notes in those classes. Anyway, Viper, let's go on. The second pasuk of this week's parsha. Se'u et rosh kol adav bnei Yisrael mishpachosam. Here comes the commandment. Take a census of the entire assembly of the children of Israel, according to their families, etc. Okay. Now, it's interesting the way the Torah phrases it. The Torah says, Se'u et rosh kol adav bnei Yisrael. Take a census of the head, right? You didn't have to write rosh. It could have just said, Se'u et kol adav bnei Yisrael. What's this notion of Se'u et rosh? Why is it that we're stressing over here the head? So, I don't have a Rishon or an Achron who says this, but I'm sure somebody does. Yeah, I just haven't had a chance to peruse through all of the Rishonim. But when I read the pasuk, came to me a talk I once heard from a person by the name of Drew Dudley. Okay? And Drew Dudley said the following. That's a real person, by the way. Drew Dudley said the following. He was giving a talk to a room full of people, and he asked, how many people in the room, and I can ask it, how many people in this room consider themselves to be leaders? Right? So maybe one hand went up. Right? And Drew Dudley contends the following. He says, the problem is that we have created a culture, a society, where we think leadership is something that is bigger than us. It is something that maybe one day I will grow into. Maybe one day I'll be good enough to be a leader. Maybe one day I'll be able to inspire other people. Maybe one day people will look up to me and admire. But we don't think ourselves as leaders nowadays. And he goes on to tell the story about a certain moment that happened to him. But you know what, I guess I'll tell you the story that happened to him. I'll shorthand it for you. But the story is the following. He was in college. He was in his freshman year of college. And he got involved in a certain charity. And one day he was trying to raise money for this charity, or simply to raise awareness for this charity. Freeze frame Drew Dudley. It was the middle of the year, as I told you, he was in the middle of his freshman year. And there was a girl who was starting her her college career in the spring semester of that year. And she was anxious. Or we'll call it Laura. Laura was anxious. She was not feeling entirely comfortable with going to college, going away from home for the first time in her life. She wasn't Jewish. She hadn't been her year in seventh, etc. She was nervous. And the night before, she was showing up at the registrar's office to register finally for her classes. Her parents said to her, listen, if at any point you feel like you can't do it, it's fine. Just say the word. We'll take you home. She woke up in the morning anxious, but feeling somewhat relieved that at least she has an ad and her parents are willing to take her home. She gets in line at the registrar and she sees all these people lined up, 100 people, literally. And she's intimidated and she thinks to herself, what was I thinking? She's nervous. Right? She doesn't know what she's thinking. As she's standing there, about to turn to her parents and say, take me home, out comes Drew Dudley wearing a silly hat and giving out lollipops to everyone. Right? Telling them about this certain charity. Right, a very silly hat. And he goes to the person online who was standing right in front of Laura, happened to have been a male, and he says to the person, would you please give this lollipop to the girl standing next to you? I think she looks like she needs a lollipop. Right? And he's like, nah. He's like, yeah, just do it. And sure enough, he takes it, he gives her the lollipop. As he gives her the lollipop, he turns to her parents and he says, can you believe it? Just one day on campus and already she's taking lollipops from strangers? What are you ever going to do with your daughter? Right? And at that point, the boy cracks up, the girl cracks up, the parents cracks up, the girl decides, Laura decides, you know what, I'm going to stay in this college, etc. That's the story. Now, Drew Dudley did not know about this story until graduation. 4 years later, the girl came up to Drew Dudley and she says to him, listen, I just want to tell you a story that happened 4 years ago. And she told him this. I was about to leave college. I wasn't going to do it. And it was because of this, you inspired me. You made me feel better. I stayed in college. She walked away. He doesn't even know her name at that point. And she says, and by the way, I'm still going out with that guy. And a year and a half later, by the way, we're getting married. So Drew Dudley makes the point that that, in his opinion, is a leadership moment. He was unaware of it, but he changed the person's life. It's what you call a turning point. He changed the person's life. She was about to pull out of college. And because of a smile and a lollipop, right, he kept her in college, which also affected the person that she ended up going out with. That's a positive turning point. Right? We also have negative turning points. Right? I'll tell you, for example, I have a person I work with in camp. He doesn't work at the Camp Moshe Va. He works with all camps. He works for the ACA. He does consulting for camps. His name is Jay Frankel. And Jay Frankel tells the following story. He's 11 years old, and he's in Camp Chippewaka.
No.
He's not prone.
No,
it's there's a lot of Jay Frankels. He's in the camp. Anyway, so it happens to be that he was born in Queens about, 40, whatever years ago. But anyway, Jay Frankel goes to Camp Chippewaka. Right, like one of these, not really called Chippewaka, but like that, Chattanooga, Chippewaka, whatever. It wasn't Chattanooga either. But anyway, he goes to the camp. And it's color war time. And they're having a dance-off as part of the color war competition. And what is a dance-off? So a dance-off is where you and a girl are paired up and you dance as a couple until you get a tap on the shoulder. And once you get a tap on the shoulder, it means you sit down. And the last two or three couples standing are the winners. So they're looking for volunteers for the dance-off, and all the girls are volunteering, and the guys are obviously hesitant. And Jay figures, what the heck? I'll do it. I'll volunteer. So here he is, an 11-year-old kid, and he's volunteering for the dance-off. Right. So, there's like this... He's there, and it's a 13-year-old girl who's dancing with him, and he's like, "Hey, my name is Jay." She's like, "Let's just dance and get this over with." Right? But anyway, they set up the room, and it's a big room, and there's a huge circle all around of all the campers that are around the circle. And if you guys ever saw Grease, the movie Grease, it's kind of like that. They have a dance up over there also. There's like everyone just standing around and watching these 15, 20 couples dancing in the middle. So Jay is getting nervous before he's about to go on. So his counselor, I guess noticing or anticipating that Jay must be nervous, and he's like, goes up, "Don't worry about it, Jay. You got it, Jay. You can dance, Jay. You're the man. He tells him how he's like, what's his name? John Travolta. You got it, man. You got it. You're the man." So Jay's like, "Yeah, I am the man. I can do this. And like the music starts, and he's in there, and he's dancing, he's moving, and he's like, and like the judges start to walk around, and they're tapping people on the shoulders. But Jay is like feeling the groove. He's moving. He's like doing like the thing where he goes in front of his eyes, and his guys are being tapped on the shoulders. He's like, "See ya. Wouldn't want to be ya." And he's dancing. He's like, "I can do this." And then he gets a tap on the shoulder. Right. He's like, "Ah, there must be some mistake." He keeps on dancing, and like they tap his shoulder again, and they point to the floor. So at the time, he had moved so much across the dance floor that he was on the opposite end of where his team was standing. So he had to walk all the way from the opposite end of the dance floor all the way till his team. And he's walking, all disappointed and all. And his counselor comes up to him, and he puts his hand on his shoulder. The same guy says, "You can do it." And he puts his hand on his shoulder, and he says, "Man, what were you thinking out there? That was ugly." And he just looks up, and he's like, "Are you kidding me?" He felt like saying, "You idiot, how can you?" He's like, "I'm an 11-year-old. You can't talk to me like that. And I've just volunteered. I put myself out there, and that's the way you're treating me?" Right? And for the next week, Jay was misbehaving in the bunk and giving attitude to this counselor. What happened over there? Right? That was a turning point also, a negative turning point. Right? Our life is constant leadership. We are constantly engaged in turning points, positive and negative. And we tend to think of ourselves as irrelevant. "No, I'm not a leader. It doesn't matter. Whatever I say doesn't matter." It matters. It matters latov. You can create lollipop moments. And it matters lara. You can crush and devastate an ego of an 11-year-old, or not an 11-year-old, a 21-year-old, or a 61-year-old. It's irrelevant. But that's what the Torah is telling us. Su et rosh b'nei Yisrael. You have to realize, member of B'nai Yisrael, that you are a leader. Like it or not, you are a leader. And with that knowledge comes a tremendous amount of responsibility. You don't have the luxury of viewing yourself as taking a back seat. I used to run a program for young teenagers in You know, people would always tell them, you are the leaders of tomorrow. And I would say that is a farce. You are not the leaders of tomorrow. You are the leaders of today. You are leaders. Right? So that's the notion over here of Se'u et Rosh B'nei Yisrael. Every member of Bnei Yisrael has to realize that he is a leader. Okay? The Shulchan Aruch in Siman Taf Chaf Ches, it's officially Hilchos Rosh Chodesh, but it's not Rosh Chodesh, the Kviyas HaMoadim. How do you set the yontibs and how, what do you lay on every yontib? So it speaks about what you lay on Shavuos. And what do you lay right before Shavuos? So the Shulchan Aruch goes through it and it says basically the parsha that you lay before Shavuos is, you should be able to figure it out because it's going to happen in just 2 days. What? Bamidbar. Excellent. Right? That's what he says in Taf Chaf Ches. He says, Ula'olam Koran Parshas B'midbar Sinai Kodem Atzeret. You always read Parshas B'midbar Sinai, Parshas B'midbar, before Atzeret. Atzeret is Shavuos. Right? And he says, the way to remember it is Siman. He gives like an acronym, the way to remember it is Manu Ve'atzru. Count, and then you have Shavuos. What does it mean when you say count? Because Parshas B'midbar, is that what you're saying? Parshas B'midbar is a census account of the Jewish people. Manu Ve'atzru. Right? Right? Count, and then you know that you have, then you know that you have Shavuos. Oh. So what's this notion of count and then you have Shavuos? So what are Shavuos? Shavuos is Kabbalah HaTorah. Right? The Shla says the following. The Shla says, and it was also said by the Shevet Sofer, the Ksav Sofer's son, the Shla says the following, as well as the Shevet Sofer. He says, what does count mean? What do you count? You count things that are meaningful to you. If you have something which is irrelevant, you're not going to count it. Right? When somebody gives you money, so you're going to make sure, let me count to make sure it's all there. Somebody gives you diamonds, you're going to count to make sure that it's all there. When somebody gives you pebbles, and they say, here's 1,000 pebbles, or even 1,000 jelly beans, chances are you're not going to sit there, oh, let me make sure it's really 1,000. Right? Or I would venture to guess that nobody's ever really counted to make sure that they have 500 sheets on the roll of toilet paper. Okay, they say it, it's okay, yeah, no, it's not all that important in my life, toilet paper, so I'll buy another roll for another 58 cents. Right? Have you ever counted it, Moshe? No. Alright, I assume Moshe is an accurate representation of the entire room. We don't count things that don't matter. Count denotes something that matters. So the Shla says that this is the notion of Torah. Right? When we got the Torah, right, then it raised our stock. Manu ve'atzru. It raised our stock to be something that is important. Not just us, but the entire planet. Right? God, when He created the world, and this is something that we keep on turning to time and time again, He says, you should know, I'm creating you heaven, and I'm creating you earth, and I'm creating you trees, and I'm creating you sun and moon. But it's not a done deal. It's not certain that the cosmos will continue to exist. What does it depend on? It depends on Yom HaShishi. The Shishi is a reference to the sixth day of Sivan. If on the sixth day of Sivan, Klal Yisrael chooses to accept the Torah, chooses to make the world something that is important, something that is meaningful, not just, you know, go through life, through the motions with that thing, but then the world will continue to exist. But absent Torah, the world will stop to exist. That is the notion of Manu Ve'atzru. The minyan, the world becomes significant, it becomes something worth counting and paying attention to once you have Atzeres, once you have Torah continuing to make the world function. But without Torah, then the world as it exists is not all that significant. Because what's the purpose? What's the point of just doing all of But if there's a deeper meaning to our life, if we have a reason to live for it, then we have a message. If we have a message to convey to ourselves and to the world, then indeed, then it is a worthwhile endeavor. Okay, let's go on with just one more word, and that is the following. Right, numbers are normally not all that exciting, particularly for someone like me, who is very, very mathematically challenged. Right? But even though I am mathematically challenged, even I can appreciate the following discrepancy that exists in the numbers of this week's parsha. Right? So first we count Bnei Israel, and after we count Bnei Israel, we count Shevet Levi. Okay? And what's the count of Shevet this? What's the count of Shevet Levi? The Torah tells us. What's the count of Shevet Levi? The Torah tells us. Kodesh Nei Levi. And the final count is. Okay. Okay. Kol Kudel Levim Asher Pakad Moshe Pasuk Lamed Tes Shnayim Ve'Esrim Elef 22,000. Now, this is 22,000 from what age? Klal Yisrael was from 20 and on. The Levim were from a month and up. Starting a month, you counted them. 22,000. Does anyone know in Klal Yisrael, we were counting from 20 and up? Meaning, we started to count 19 years later by Klal Yisrael. What was the smallest Shevet? I think it was. Dan or Shimon? It wasn't Shimon, maybe it was Dan. I don't remember. Something like 40,000. So that's a very, very odd thing. Because Shevet Levi, you're counting a larger age group, and the number you're arriving at doesn't even add up to half of a Shevet of the small Shevet of Bnei Israel. How does that happen? If you do the math of what would be the age of Shevet Levi from 20 and up, they would come to maybe a third of the next Shevet. So how can it be that Shevet Levi is so small compared to everyone else? How could it be? What happened suddenly? They're not even half the size. What happened to Shevet Levi? What was that?
Asher.
What was the number?
41,000.
So what happened to Shevet Levi? So just about half, 22,000. What happened to Shevet Levi? Okay. So the Ramban suggests that it's very simple. The Ramban suggests that the reason why Shevet Levi did not multiply in the same rate as Bnei Israel was because Shevet Levi, the Midrash tells us, was not in the Shiabud. They were not enslaved. And because they were not enslaved,
they were more leisurely.
What?
They were more leisurely. They didn't have like six kids at a time. They had like.
Oh, so, right. That's, we're going to do that in a second. That's what it comes. So the Ramban says, what did God say? Parah says, oh yeah, I'm going to enslave you so that you don't multiply. And God said, oh yeah, you think you're going to enslave them so that they don't multiply? Look at what happened. They're going to have six at a shot, like Asher just said. Six at one time. But who did that apply to?
The slaves.
The slaves. But since Shevet Levi wasn't slaves,
it didn't apply to them.
It didn't apply to them. That's what the Ramban says. Okay, leave that aside. The Orach Chaim does not like it for a few reasons. And the Orach Chaim says something else. He says the following. Alright, and this I think maybe Asher touches about what you were saying before. we know that Amram, Moshe's father, separated from Yocheved, right? Until Miriam told him, you know, you really shouldn't be doing that. Says the Arachim, you know what? It wasn't just Amram. All of Shevet Levi separated from their wives. Why? He said the following. Since they were not enslaved, they were pampered, if you will, right? They didn't feel the hardship, right? They were kind of sitting in an ivory tower, right? And once they were sitting in an ivory tower, they're like, you know, why should I have a child only to have him thrown in the living? They were very, very comfortable. They couldn't relate to what the Jewish people were going through. Right? They felt, what for us to go ahead and have children and have to run around like bandits on the run? You know, like they knew that the Jewish women went out to the field to have their children and then come back. That's not me. I shouldn't have to go through that. I live a more indulgent life. This is an incrimination of them, says the Aruch Haim. He says they felt detached from the people. And the minute they felt detached from the people, they didn't, right, they couldn't sympathize and go through the same thing. There has to be a sense of empathy in order to go ahead and throw your lot in with the rest of the Jewish people. Something which at this point it seems like Shevet Levi lacked. Right? When somebody is suffering, the idea is not to just distance yourself and say, well, I'm not going. The idea is to try to feel the pain that he's going through and to try to help and better his situation. Really an idea that has to be developed more fully, but we don't have the time for now. We'll stop here. And Blina, we didn't get into many words this week, but Blina, Parshas Naso, we'll continue.
A great story, that's